Hello and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, not just in Brisbane, but all across the country, wherever we're broadcasting from. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present, and also the elders of non-First Nations people or more recent arrivals listening in today. Welcome to all our listeners tuned in Brisbane, and also if you're listening via the internet through our podcast or live, welcome to you as well. Today we're talking again. Last week we talked about the death in custody of Jalika Ju, a 22-year-old Yemeji woman who died after being arrested for unpaid parking fines in South Hedland in Western Australia last year, and it was actually the first anniversary of her death on Tuesday. You might not have heard a lot about it because there wasn't a great deal of media coverage outside of the Aboriginal media, which was sad. Today we're going to talk about another death in custody, and thankfully it was one that drew a lot more media attention, and there were several reasons for that. In November 2004, Mulrunji Dumiji was killed. It was arrested for swearing and singing drunkenly at a police officer, Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley. Within an hour of his arrest, he died on the Palm Island Watch House floor of injuries so horrific, among them a liver cleaved in two, almost cleaved in two, a ruptured lung, and also injuries akin to a high-speed car accident or plane crash victim. Now, after Mulrunji died, there was silence across the national landscape, particularly in the media. It wasn't until Palm Islanders, after hearing the extent of Mulrunji's injuries through an autopsy report and staged an uprising, that the media, the government, both federal and state, actually took notice. I want to play you a clip from The Tall Man, which was the award-winning film, documentary film based on the case, to refresh your memory.
There was a fall.
I then stood there and said to them exactly what coroner had said.
And the doctor, Dr. Clinton, explained that it was what he called compressive force on his body, where four ribs were broken, and that caused a rupture in his liver.
Compressive force was placed on his chest, broke his ribs,
which meant there was a big blood loss. It was a fall.
They didn't break four ribs from one fall.
If I go and kill somebody like that, they'll fly me off to prison quick, save them than anyone else here. Put him in prison where he belongs. Come on, people. We all wanted this. We wanted to know. But we accept this as an accident.
I'm not going to accept.
Demonstrations are just down there. And they've just found out how Dumiji died, yelling out riots with the police, riots with the police.
Riots with the police, riots with the police. It was this word, riot, to describe the uprising of Palm Islanders in the wake of the death in custody of Mulrunji Dumiji that really drew international attention to Palm Island and national attention, which in itself is a sad thing. As we said before, as we discussed before with Jalika Ju last week, there's never been a police officer convicted in relation to the death in custody of an Aboriginal man. There's been two occasions in which police officers have been charged, once in the case of John Pat over in Roebourne, a teenage boy who was bashed to death by off-duty police officers in 1983, and it sparked one of the cases that sparked the Royal Commission, and the second time with Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley in regards to Mulrunji Dumiji. But of course, as you would all remember, it took a long time for that to occur. Two coronial inquests, the second coronial inquest in 2006 by Christine Clements, found that Chris Hurley was responsible for Mulrunji's death. In December of that same year, the DPP, State DPP, Leanne Clare, decided that she would not be prosecuting Chris Hurley over Mulrunji's death. It led to an outcry, and in 2007, an independent inquiry by Sir Lawrence Street was announced, which found that there was enough evidence to prosecute Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley. That culminated in 2007 with charges for manslaughter and assault, for which Hurley was acquitted. But when we look at the Palm Island saga, do we consider it real justice for the people of Palm Island? And the reason we're talking about this today is because there is an update in the case, not so much the case, but in what's happening next. And that comes in the form of a class action that Palm Island is taking out against the Queensland Police Service and also the state of Queensland. And it all revolves around allegations of institutionalised racial discrimination. When we talk about institutionalised racial discrimination with Palm Island in mind, I immediately thought of the excuses that came up from government officials, people like Queensland Premier at the time, Peter Beattie, and Judy Spence, the police minister, and how they treated Palm Island. And a question that is going to come up in the class action is, was an Aboriginal community, Palm Island, treated any differently to a white community? Would this have happened in a white community where they would have felt the same discrimination by the police force, by the Queensland Police, and also by the government? So I want to play another clip from The Tall Man, which discusses a little bit about that institutionalised racism in the history of Palm.
Palm Island is a beautiful place. We live in the Great Barrier Reef, 40 kilometres northeast of Townsville, over 3,100 Indigenous residents.
It has always been a community with high levels of violence and alcoholism. Even now, a third of the students don't go to school on any given day despite our best efforts.
It's not easy work. It's not easy work at all. And in fact, a lot of people don't want to go to Indigenous communities to work because of the isolation and the extreme pressures.
Domestic violence is one of the greatest things that people are going to struggle with on Palm Island.
Palm Island is a place where black folks have grown up under the thumb of the white man.
Palm was more the punishment place, more than any of the other missions, and was set up and run like a penal type colony. Waking up to bells, going to sleep to bells, lining up and off to work, the ration, the dormitory.
Terrible history. Terrible history.
Yes, a very tragic history indeed, and those were the closing words of Erica Kyle, who was the Palm Island mayor at the time of Mulrunji's death. And the reason I wanted to play that excerpt from the brilliant documentary The Tall Man is because it discusses a little bit about what we're going to talk about today, and that's institutionalised racism. The first woman quoted in that excerpt was Judy Spence, who was the former Queensland Police Minister and the Police Minister at the time. She said in that grab that a third of the children on Palm Island still don't go to school despite our best efforts. Despite our best efforts, it seems to me that the onus is again placed on Aboriginal communities rather than looking at the historical apathy from successive governments, not just on Palm Island, not just in Queensland, but all around the country. And I think it goes to that, the very heart of the issue that we're going to be talking about today, and also talking about that history of Palm Island. The man who was quoted just before talking about blackfellas have always been under the thumb of the white man. The words of Palm Island Mayor Alf Lacey, of Palm being a penal colony. Today we're going to talk to Lex Wotton, who was accused of being the leader of the Palm Island uprising or riots, and also was one of those who faced jail time over the uprising. In 2004, police actually raided his house, took him into custody, and he was ultimately charged under a number of charges for rioting and destruction. He was convicted of that and was handed a prison sentence of, I think, about 6 years to 7 years in prison. He was released on parole after 2 years, but under very strict conditions, under very strict parole conditions set by corrections in Queensland. And those were effectively a media gag. He wasn't allowed to speak to media, and he wasn't allowed to attend open political gatherings or community events. Those strict bail conditions were taken to the High Court, and the lawyers representing Lex took it to the High Court, I think, in around 2012 or 2013, and unfortunately were unsuccessful, which says a lot about freedom of speech in this country, the fact we can have a debate over the right of Andrew Bolt and the right of him to racially discriminate against Aboriginal people in print using his sizable microphone, and yet cases like this come up. But that's another story. As I spoke about before, we're talking about the class action in Palm Island, and the reason that it's so topical quite at the moment is because there is going to be a hearing in September on Palm Island, September 7th, and a full week of hearings, and a full week of hearings in Townsville, and then two in Brisbane. So last year, the lawyers representing Lex Wotton, who's the lead plaintiff, along with his mother and his wife, put out a media release explaining in detail a little bit about what they are doing in the federal court. And it concerns allegations of institutionalized racial discrimination from the Queensland Police Service following the death in custody of Mulrunji. Now, they say in this press release, an internal investigation into Mulrunji's death cleared the police of all wrongdoing. An internal investigation. In 2010, Queensland's Crime and Misconduct Commission concluded that, in quotes, the investigation into the death of Mulrunji was seriously flawed, its integrity gravely compromised in the eyes of the very community it was meant to serve. The death in custody and flawed police investigation sparked a protest in the local community, since dubbed the Palm Island Riots by the media. In response, the Queensland Police declared a state of emergency on the island and sent in a special unit of heavily armed police officers. The crack police unit stormed the homes of dozens of Palm Island residents to arrest them in front of their families, tasering some and dragging others out of their homes naked. Now, Lex Wotton was one of those men. He was also tasered. I spoke to him earlier this week about his experiences and what he hopes to achieve from the class action. First of all, thanks so much for being on the program. You're currently on Palm Island at the moment. Can I take you back to the day of the Palm uprising, or what the media called a riot? Can you tell me what led to the events and what the general feeling was like on the island on that day?
Well, I suppose when you go back a week before, as it's widely known, there was a death in custody here, and which led to a police cover-up of what initially happened on that particular day on the 19th of November. And and that was widely publicised, a three inquest into the actual death, which found that there was collusion and stuff. There was a cover-up. And then from that, during that week, there was a series of meetings here, and myself and others, we called on the Premier at the time, Beattie, and Police Minister Spence, and Police Commissioner Atkinson to come over to the island and give us assurance that things will be handled in a manner that I thought, anyway. There was a Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths and Custody, and those protocols would be followed. So,
and you didn't hear anything from Atkinson, from Beattie, or from Spence, did you?
Nah. Well, there was an actual resolution put forward to the government on behalf of the community through the local council on a letterhead, on council's letterhead, and asking them to attend here so that we can get a just outcome, I suppose. And like I said, after that, they refused to come. There were a series of meetings from the Monday, which was the 22nd, I think. And from then up until the 26th, there was a series of meetings falling on full, hoping that the there would be a fair investigation into the whole matter, and then the coroner's report was given to the family, I think, the night before the 25th, and then it was known publicly that they were going to give a public account of what led to the death.
Yeah. So this was the autopsy results, was it, which was read out at the community? Yeah.
Yeah, and then upon hearing that, things happened where the community took action, and which led to what is widely known as the Palm Island Riot. And there's a lot to explain.
Yeah, the thing I find amazing is the fact that Palm Islanders wanted to work with government to try and create some sort of resolution before the uprising. And it was only after the uprising that anyone visited the island, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, as you may or may not be aware, or the public may not be aware, is that when things happened on that particular day, the only people that were allowed on the island was police, because there was a declared state of emergency, and through court hearings on behalf of myself and my co-accused, it was found that the actual state of emergency was illegal. It was declared it was illegal. They didn't follow protocols there. So then, which led to some of the locals, whether you were a local person on the island or a local person on the mainland, you weren't allowed to enter Palm. So then the only people that were allowed in were the police, the increase of police. I think there ended up probably 100-odd-something police officers flown into the community, plus counter-terrorism squads and stuff like that. And then the only people that were allowed to leave the island were non-Indigenous, and they felt no threat from the community, but they were asked to leave. They were more or less taken off, forced off the island. So,
because you asked them to leave, and you wanted to negotiate with them even during the uprising, wasn't it?
Yeah, I confronted the officer in charge at the time to leave the island so that the island could, you know, settle down, and then you know, that's all they needed for the police to remove themselves, and things would be okay. But then a few hours later, I found out they were bloody more or less setting me up and stuff like that. And so I confronted them about that, and then they did raise it that the place was declared a state of emergency, and that they weren't going anywhere, and that people were coming in and stuff like that. So, then I suppose the next day I was arrested on the charges of, there was 9 different charges the next day, but then as the things went on over a period of time, the charges changed to a fray and stuff like that, some old 1,800 charges, which, so if I went down, I'd go down for everything. Yeah.
Wow, and you remember that day, the day after the uprising, because you were readying yourself for the police to come, for the police to raid your house, weren't you?
Yeah, I was actually waiting. And so they came in and they it was raised in the middle proceedings that I was looking for an escape route, but I saw them coming, you know, half a mile away, so I could have, you know, abandoned my household at that time. But no, I was standing there in a pair of shorts just waiting for them to come and stuff like that. So, and then it was deemed when my arrest was illegal and everything else. So, yeah.
Do you remember what happened? What was the time they came in and what actually happened during the raid?
Well, right on 5 o'clock. And,
in the morning?
They asked me to get down on my knees and stuff so that I could then on my stomach so that they could handcuff me and stuff like that. But I didn't do that because take those directions because I had my wife and my children in the house and they... I was afraid for them if they'd walk out and someone, you know, those from the anti-terror squad, if all they call it, said, if they panicked, they might have, you know, shot someone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's why I didn't take any their orders to sit down and stuff like that. So they ended up hitting me with the taser and, I went down and then they handcuffed me and then... one of the actual lead investigator into the officer, Haley, Darren Robinson, he gave orders for Sid to go into the house after one of the Sid officers said, what about in the house? And I said to him, there's no need to go in there because you got who you want. And they ended up going into the house and pulling guns on the children and stuff like that, going through the house and
What was the effect on your children and your wife?
Oh, look, it affected their education and stuff like that because we had them going out to the college the year after, you know, within months from that, and it played an enormous role on their education and stuff like that. And, overall, health-wise, you know, you go to the courts every couple of months, stuff like that. It played a role for the public, I suppose. I wasn't allowed back to the island. I was under strict conditions on the mainland and stuff like that. Couldn't attend public meetings and stuff like that in town in relation to the death and custody. I was under a care field from 7 in the evening till 6 in the morning. Had to report every day, you know, to the police station in Townsville. I think about 8 months before I was allowed to come back to my community, so I couldn't actually attend the deceased's funeral and stuff like that. I couldn't have Christmas with them, so she had to come into town to if I wanted to have Christmas with them. But when she was in there, she had an accident where in the shopping centre and she hit her leg, so she ended up coming back to the island, so things like that.
Yeah, and that was in the lead-up to the conviction because you were charged with causing a riot or... a few charges, and you were jailed for 2 years in Townsville.
I got a 7-year sentence, and the judge said, oh, you can do 6, and then he recommended parole after 2, which knocked off 4 years, which I'll not knock off. I'm still actually a prisoner then for the next 4 years. So if I breached any of my bail conditions when I was released on parole, I'd go back and finish the remaining 4 years or what's left of the 4 years. I was then given 2 years. The judge took off 110 days off the 2 years, which I ended up doing, I think, 20 months.
But even then you had very strict parole conditions. You couldn't talk to media. You couldn't attend any public community events.
That wasn't put on by the actual judge. That was put on by... Corrective Services to parole the parole board, which was very first in the country when it comes to media and like, well, I couldn't attend public meetings here on the island and stuff like that. Drug and alcohol testing, which I don't drink or smoke for 20 odd years. So.
It's interesting because the saddest thing about this whole thing is that the only people who've been jailed over the death in custody of Mulrunji Dimiji have been Aboriginal people, people like yourself and the other people who were convicted over the uprising. And compared that to the treatment by police and by Hurley, it's very inconsistent, isn't it, the fact that we're at a stage where blackfellas were ultimately jailed over the death in custody.
Yeah, well, every time someone dies now, I suppose a lot of our members within their communities have to be very cautious, I suppose, what they say and do, because you'll be labelled as an agitator or something, you know what I mean? And then for raising your concern, because you have concerns, because you fear that someone is... You know, there isn't going to be a proper investigation, I suppose, into... is it yesterday there was 1 year for the lady over in Western Australia, a young girl that died in custody, you know, and that's just on... what was it for fine? She was incarcerated for not paying her fines, and then, you know, she... And there hasn't ever been an actual inquest into this.
No.
Death. So, yeah, you see, nothing really changed since the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths and Custody, which was handed down in 2003, I think, 93.
Yeah, 1991, even longer ago.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And that's why you're involved in a class action, along with Palm Island. You're the leading plaintiff. Can you tell me a bit about this class action and why you're following through with it?
Well, I spoke to the lawyers some time ago before I actually went to trial, and we talked about stuff, and because I inquired whether I would be able to sue the state and stuff, but because we were waiting for my trial to proceed and stuff like that. There's a statute of time where you have to actually lodge applications and stuff like that, but because of that process we were going through, which I ran short, so we looked at possibly a class action on behalf of the whole community, and myself, my wife, Cecilia, and Mum, we're lead applicants, so it actually covers the whole community. And what we're saying is institutional racism, how we were treated compared to how the police officer was treated, and how the police service treated the whole community by way of investigating the actual death itself, and a lot of things we're ignored, so we're saying that there's institutional racism.
And
that's our argument. Yeah.
I mean, you can just see it in what happened after the uprising, where blackfellas were charged and yet the police officers involved in it were given bravery awards. I mean, that says a lot about institutionalised racism, doesn't it?
Yes. Look, there's a lot. Hopefully... That's what the lawyers are bringing up, you know, like the case. I've seen a bit of the paperwork, and I feel comfortable with it and stuff like that. So, you know, it's, everything's, we're just finalising some of the paperwork now to the court system. So, yeah, I've got to meet with the lawyers on Monday in Brisbane. And, look, I have a lot of confidence in it, but look, we're up against a system that hasn't budged for Black Australia in some sense when it comes to justice, but hopefully we might have a good outcome. So,
And it's not just the police, isn't it? You're also looking at Queensland as a whole. And when you think about the fact that the police minister, the premier and the police commissioner wouldn't even come to Palm before the uprising happened, it's not just about the police, is it? It's the whole way Queensland's set up.
Yeah, well, yeah, the way the government institutions and how they treat our communities, whether it's within the justice system or health, you can name a few other things that, you know, have responsibility for our people. And hopefully in the near future, I think that's where we as Aboriginal communities need to look at possibly, hopefully, when I get around, I want to talk to other communities to actually put a joint one in with the communities, because our communities were actually set up as penal colonies, Palm Island. So overall, when you look at the deaths in our communities, whether it's through health reasons or just old age and stuff like that, and we're still a penal colony, you know what I mean? So just because we were given some sort of documentation to say we're dogged communities, but we're still governed by the government institutions, which, you know, they tell us how to live our lives.
Has anything changed on, have you seen any changes, positive changes, since the death in custody?
A lot of things happened here on arms and stuff, but Australia-wide when it comes to policing in communities, not a lot has changed. I don't think they carry out a lot of these cultural awareness programs. They probably do, but I don't think the young officers or whoever goes through these things still don't understand how to communicate or police things according to protocol in these various programs when it comes to cultural awareness programs. You know what I mean?
So I think
The Queensland police got a long way to go there, given the Queensland government. So, and materially on the ground, time has progressed, but that's a given. And as I said, when I was asked about what happened on that particular day, that evening, I gave a report to the Courier Mail, and my initial report to them was it was never about an actual the death of custody itself. It was about a justice issue.
Yeah.
And when I mean justice issue, not particularly just with that particular death, but overall justice in a lot of areas, but also the neglect towards our communities from government institutions. So the government is has a lot to answer for in a lot of areas, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely true. And there was a meeting last year where lawyers, your lawyers, talked to the Palm community about this class action. What's the feeling amongst your community about what the class action could potentially achieve?
Well, at the moment we're trying to organise a thing, hopefully in the next fortnight, to inform the community a bit more on what it's all about. A lot of the people don't understand what it's all about, but some do, and it's just another thing. Look, people have moved on, I suppose, in some sense. We're hoping to hold a few series of meetings in the community, but because of liability and stuff, I can't just go out and call a meeting and inform people. So, so we're working together with the mayor of Palm and the sergeant of police here, and but because it's illegal stuff, there's some legal issues. We're waiting on the Queensland police and their solicitors and the government solicitors to come back, because I think the police are feeling a bit tense about what will happen at that particular time, and I'm telling them, look, don't worry about what's going to happen. I don't know why they feel so afraid that things might happen, you know, in a bad way, because we got, for the listeners, we got on the 7th of next month, we've got a week-long hearing here on the island.
Yep.
And then the following week in Townsville and the remaining 2 weeks in Brisbane. So, yeah, hopefully I could catch up with a lot of my friends down in Brisbane, you know, friends, supporters and stuff like that. Hopefully they can come to the fourth and give us some support there.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure you've got a lot of supporters everywhere around the country. So
yeah.
I'm hoping a lot of people come out. But,
yeah, and hopefully a lot of our communities are also watching the case and following it, because, like I said, I think maybe Australia-wide we should be taking the stance of institutional racism. It's the first in the country, so, yeah.
The first in the country, is it, do a class action on institutionalised racism?
Yeah, as far as I know, so.
Wow. And my last question is basically, there was never really any sort of justice when you think back to Mulrunji Doomadgee's death. Will this deliver, in some sense, a form of justice or another form of healing for the community, do you think?
If it's a bit of both, I suppose. A bit of both. And, you know, overall, like I said, the community moved forward and, in whatever form we're compensated, if we get a good outcome, it's up to us to say what form of thing. But you don't want to, like I said to the lawyer, you don't want to confuse that with what's a given by what the government already gives to other communities, whether you're black or white, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we don't have as much as white communities. So I think they should, but don't confuse this lawsuit with what we should have from the government anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So,
yeah. And at the heart of it, it's about the fact that Palm Island was treated differently because it's an Aboriginal community, isn't it? And that no other Indigenous and no other community in Australia would have been treated the same way.
Yeah, well, like I say, community and anti-terrorist squad ran around with iPad rifles pointed at kids and stuff. That wouldn't happen in mainstream Australian white communities. There'd be a outcry, it'd be an international outcry, and it'd be in the media all over the world, you know, and there'd be inquest into why did that happen and stuff like that. But yeah, look, I think overall in the when we go to court, hopefully a lot of the stuff, you know, it'll give an insight to what really happened here when a lot of the people, because of there was a lot of backlash or criticism towards myself, they'll see a different side to what was really, what really took place here.
Yeah.
And, and they might have... we might gain more support, I suppose, not only for myself and my community, but an understanding for what how our communities have to put up with on a daily basis when it comes to government institutional racism.
That's so true. And on that note, thank you so much for talking to me, and hopefully we'll talk again soon. And I wish you all the best of luck with the class action as well. And I think it's something we'll be following very closely, and I hope other media outlets follow just as closely. So. That was Lex Wotton, the lead plaintiff in a class action on behalf of Palm Islanders following the death in custody of Mulrunji Doomadgee. It's going to the Federal Court of Australia, and hearings begin in Palm Island in September. And it's around allegations of institutionalised racial discrimination within the Queensland Police Service in relation to the death in custody, and also looking at the wider state of Queensland. And as Lex was saying, that he hopes that it's a case that's followed not just by media but also Aboriginal communities around the country. It could particularly be one of the first cases of its kind alleging this sort of institutionalised racism, which is, it lies at the heart. It's not just about the death in custody, but I guess the historic apathy that we've seen governments show towards Aboriginal communities. And as he says, It's about, would this have happened? What we saw in relation to the Queensland Police Service, the disregard for Mulrunji's life, the continual flaws in the investigation. I mean, the investigation was fundamentally flawed, including Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley's friend actually investigated him, dined at his house the night that he landed on Palm Island, a whole history, a litany of problems that came out in the Crime and Misconduct Commission's report. Would that have happened to a white community? Would we have seen a case where a white community would have been grappling with the same issues? And I think what happened on Palm Island in 2004 and the events ensuing following that is probably the greatest travesty in Queensland history. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens after the class action. And we've got to remember, I mean, it's all on the public record, but the events leading up to the death in relation to Chris Hurley, including allegations when Chris Hurley's friend, Detective Darren Robinson, was appointed to investigate allegations that Hurley had run over an Aboriginal woman with a police vehicle. The woman was actually airlifted from Palm with her shin bone sticking through her skin. A doctor actually told investigators he felt pressured by police to agree the incident never occurred. And twice, Chris Hurley's friend, who was investigating, Darren Robinson, submitted false reports to his superiors in Townsville claiming the incident was fictitious. It came out several times. There was another instance also 3 months after that where Detective Darren Robinson, again Chris Hurley's friend, was amongst about half a dozen other police who saw Hurley assault another Aboriginal man. He claimed it was simply a slap. So there was a history of this by Chris Hurley, and then we got to remember that Robinson was also one of the officers who had dinner and drank beers with Hurley on the night Mulrunji was killed. So there's a whole litany of problems with the police investigation that are on the public record, that are in the Crime and Misconduct Commission if you want to read it. So it will be very interesting. Beautiful song there by Kev Carmody, and very fitting to what we're talking about today, which was the death in custody of Mulrunji Dimaji, but also the class action that's being launched on behalf of Palm Island. We spoke to the leading plaintiff, Lex Warden, a short time ago, and it'll be something that we continue to speak about. Now, next up, the past couple of weeks, we've been playing Uncle Ross Watson's River Story. It's a beautiful tale about development, but love of country and the importance of caring for country and how country cares for you. Here's the 9th installment of River Story, and I hope you enjoy.
Over the years, the grass seed clans brought more and more seed food as their contribution to the gatherings. When questioned about their traditional proper food, they said their country was experiencing a shortage. They said this even during the good seasons, and concern continued to build as more and more of the totem links weakened. Surrounding clans became alarmed as their country was encroached upon by the grass people when hunting to supplement their seed diet. This was necessary because their own country was now depleted of many species by the degradation of land from tilling the soil. Yes, the disrespect for clan boundaries caused upsets that echoed farther than their own cultural blocks. Eventually, when numbers increased, they invaded the country of neighbouring clans to carry out their grass dreaming. Big meetings soon descended into bitter fights where all the grass clans defended their own, regardless of right or wrong. This behaviour was in direct contradiction to the ancient protocols, and a series of meetings took place in surrounding areas not infiltrated or influenced by the aggressive grass people. The meetings sent delegations under totemic procedure to inspect the various breeding places and important sites within the grass clan areas. Some of the delegations did not return, and others were attacked, with few survivors escaping. Those returning from the grass-growing areas reporting seeing huge areas cleared of trees, where groups of people toiled, dragging weighted logs to turn the soil. The workers seemed to be controlled by small groups of armed men, On several occasions, they witnessed the brutal beating of exhausted workers who appeared reluctant to continue the heavy work. They spoke of permanent camps where people seemed to be busy moving in groups or working adjoining skins together or sitting under big structures covered with matted leaves. In the camps also, armed individuals appeared to direct most of the activities, but the violence occurred less often than in the fields. The concealed observers were puzzled and greatly concerned. Such things were alien to traditional lifestyle. What has become of sacred stories and lore to allow such changes? The new lifestyle also began to change the body shape of the grass people. Their muscles thickened and their bulkier bodies were less agile in movement. Their hands were heavily calloused and more of them were seen to be wearing leather wrapping on feet and ankles. And some covered their bodies with animal skins, even during warm seasons. When they travelled, things were placed in bound sapling frames on flat timber pieces, curved at the front to allow smooth progress when pulled along the ground. At the big gatherings, the grass people excelled in activities requiring physical strength and became noted for greatly celebrating any victory over weaker competitors. They caused unease by lavishing praise and respect on the strongest and scorn on the weaker. Many of the free people could only wonder at the competitive character of the grass eaters' new lifestyle. Concern increased for the health and care of totem species in the grass country. Further information was provided by some who had lived among the grass people. They reported strange behaviour in the areas. Most people lived in permanent camps or villages. They no longer followed their correct movement around country to monitor breeding places and perform ceremony. They said the large population contained few full and proper people. The workers were considered less than full human and were under the control of somebody called chief. The chief had a few people called shamans and other people who were known as bullymen. The role of the shaman was to continually remind the work people how fortunate they were to have such a generous chief. They said if the chief and his forefathers had not expanded the practice of tilling the soil, the country could not have sustained so many of them. Thus, they owed their existence to the chief and had no reason to honour the land, creation, or any of the creator spirits whose laws opposed their new lifestyle. The main activity of the bullymen was to enforce the authority of their chief and punish any who dared to resist. The families of the shamans and bullymen enjoyed more privileges than the workers, and the main purpose in life of a chief's family was to control everybody and kill dissenters. And so it was. The work people allowed the chief's people to think for them and carried out their wishes. They did so before looking after their own families or totems. In any case, most children were removed from parents while little more than toddlers. They were reared in compounds where they were educated to be submissive slaves and beasts of burden. After some generations, most of the workers did not properly understand or remember their totems, and the kinship system was no longer considered relevant amongst them. Shamans exploited their ignorance mercilessly, as if they were children. Few were skilled or informed sufficiently to argue against the shaman's reasoning. In any case, what allegiance could they maintain to a country that would deny them their very lives? According to the serpent's laws, their numbers exceeded the land's capacity to provide. Shamans advised it was better to live as slaves than not at all. and persistent dissenters were slain to avert rebellion.
That was Uncle Ross Watson with River Story, a beautiful ode to country. Hope you enjoy it. Tomorrow we have Noel Pearson joining us to talk about constitutional reform, hopefully some stuff that's going on up the Cape, and also his controversial teaching method, direct instruction. We'll hopefully have a great deal of time to talk about that tomorrow. For now, I hope that you have a good day. We're edging closer to the weekend. I'm looking forward to that. For now, I'll bid you goodbye and talk soon. Talk tomorrow.